Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manil, and I'm your host. On today's program, Community Radio Pioneers. We'll listen to two interviews from the 2006 archives that look back at the past and future of community radio and community media. Do stay tuned. I was really pleased that in 2006, I was able to air interviews with Bill Thomas and Jeremy Landsman. Bill is one of the founding members of Media Geek's home station, WEFT, in Champaign, Illinois, and continues to work in public service broadcasting at North Dakota Public Radio. Jeremy is a longtime radio experimenter who helped found the first community radio station outside of Pacifica Network, and who now operates a TV station in Anchorage, Alaska. First, we'll listen to part of my interview with Bill Thomas, who tells us why and how a group of people decide to put a community radio station on the air in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois.
I moved to Champaign-Urbana in 1975 after having worked at a couple of stations in St. Louis. The one I guess that had the most influence on me was KDNA, which is now sort of incarnated as KDHX in St. Louis. It was a very exciting station, and in that the people who had started it were really willing to try a lot of different things, and it was at that time was very exciting to just see a station that would play different kinds of music, because that was really unusual, and a station that was kind of open to talking about some kind of topics. At the time, hot topics were the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, differing views on feminism, and all of that kind of 60s, 70s discussion and ferment was being talked about, and music was being played on the station that addressed it, and so on. And that was pretty exciting. So that had got me really turned on to doing that kind of radio. I also, while I was in St. Louis, helped start a small 10-watt community station out of a neighborhood center in the Black Ghetto in St. Louis, in a mostly black area, that was sort of a community organizing station in some ways. But anyway, so I had been doing that stuff in St. Louis. I moved up to Champaign-Urbana because my wife got into grad school there, and I had gotten this station going in St. Louis in the black community, and I kind of felt like I should withdraw and people from the local community should run it. And so it seemed like a good time to leave. And I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do up in Champaign-Urbana, and I started asking around about radio things, and I met some people, especially the program director and sort of de facto manager and of a station called WTWC. And WTWC had been a station that typified something that happened, especially in college towns in the 60s and 70s, of the commercial underground FM station, as they were called. It was a commercial station, but they were kind of having a lot of the ideas that some of the things that came out in community radio were too. So they played a wider range of music, and they played jazz and more unusual rock and popular music and some folk music and bluegrass and things like that. So it was mostly in music that they were exploring and doing some things differently. The people I met there at that station were actually a little dissatisfied with some of the things that were going on there, but they thought maybe they could do some things with that commercial station in that format. I talked to them about, they were very curious about the experiences I'd had with the station in St. Louis, and we talked about it. Meanwhile, I was in sort of trying to figure out what I was going to do. I was communicating with a group of stations that were, some of them were college connected stations, some of them were independent community stations that were these non-commercial stations that were trying this different kind of programming and doing this wild variety of music and a lot of different voices on the air and so on. And most of these stations were, most of the people at them thought their station was the only one in the country because they were so unusual, you know. And some of the people had been inspired by hearing WBAI in New York or KPFA in San Francisco, and they thought, well, there's like one in San Francisco, and then there's one here in Yellow Springs, Ohio, or there's one here in Pittsburgh, and they didn't really realize that there were, you know, that kind of the same idea had occurred to some different people, and they were trying it. So I started, I thought there was maybe some value to come from having better relations and networking among these stations. So I started just corresponding and started kind of a newsletter. And one of the things that we started talking about right away was exchanging programs by tape. And so we were just, you know, exchanging ideas about that. And people said, you know, we should have a meeting. We should get together in person. And so we decided to have a meeting. And I had a friend who was working on starting a station in Madison, Wisconsin, which did start and became WORT up there. But at that point, they were just organizing for it. So he said that we could have it in Madison. He thought he could come up with a place for us to have it up there and find places for people to stay when they came to town, because most people didn't have much money to spend on travel and hotels and stuff. So we pulled together this meeting, and it was a very exciting meeting. It was kind of the first one of its type. There were only a couple of people there from Pacifica, but there were, a little less than 100, I think, people there from groups all over the country that had started or were trying to start stations. And, that big excitement that comes with, like, oh, you want to have a feminist show too? You're going to have a blues show and you're going to play jazz and bluegrass and stuff, and you're going to talk about these political issues, and wow, we are too. And people were almost giddy, you know, with excitement at realizing that there were these other people that were trying to do the same thing. And there was a lot of sharing of knowledge and a lot of, just a lot of solidarity. But also out of it came an idea to start a national organization, which became the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, and to start an exchange of tapes. So the people from Champaign-Urbana, from WTWC, the commercial station who had come up, were very interested in all this and excited about it. And they got back to Champaign-Urbana, and literally within a few days after this conference, the owner of the station announced that he was totally changing. They were going to go to just a regular commercial format, and the underground commercial FM station was at an end. So, you know, the people who had come up from Champaign-Urbana to this meeting were very fired up about the idea of starting radio stations. They had just been talking with all these people that were in the process of starting radio stations. And I stayed up in Madison for a few days to wrap up stuff from the conference, and then I got back to Champaign-Urbana, and everybody was like, we've called a meeting. The commercial station is over, and we're going to start a community radio station, and can you run the meeting? And Bill Taylor had come up to Madison, and two people who are no longer in Champaign-Urbana, Joe Lex and Andrea Urban, had come up, and they were all very excited about it. There was a meeting about, you know, just kind of word of mouth spread, mostly among people who'd kind of had some kind of connection with WTWC. And there was a whole variety of people there. And the consensus was, yeah, good idea. Let's start a non-commercial radio station. The term community radio hadn't really become a way of talking about it yet at that point. And so people didn't have a handy handle for it, but they'd say, yeah, you know, an alternative station that plays a lot of different kinds of music and has lots of discussion and covers lots of ideas and involves lots of people. And so, you know, there was sort of a vague mandate from this meeting and a list of names and an idea of, yeah, let's organize some fundraisers and let's start trying to start a radio station. I know that was a long story about NFCB and that first community radio conference in Madison, but that really kind of was the spark that kicked off the idea of starting a station in Champaign-Urbana.
I'm really glad you started there, because I think a lot of people in Champaign-Urbana don't realize how really towards the beginning of, you know, the movement we can call community radio, WEFT really was. And I think a lot of people don't always realize that aside from Pacifica, in a lot of ways, there weren't a lot of community stations, and especially not in the way we think about it, like you mentioned.
Yeah, no, that's really true. It was kind of there in that kind of mid-70s that people started to realize that you could maybe do this. You could maybe pull this off. I think before that, most people had thought a radio station was just not something that people thought was, you know, within the grasp of any kind of, you know, community organization. Except, people thought, well, okay, in New York and San Francisco, you know, where the Pacifica stations were, in Los Angeles, maybe in those big cosmopolitan cities, but in smaller communities that weren't so famously alternative or cosmopolitan or whatever you want to call it, the idea that you could start a station that would be this kind of a station was just, you know, something that just a lot of people hadn't thought you could do. And then there were a few specific people that were really kind of national organizers for this in a very informal but very effective way. So they developed a kind of a brain trust, I guess you could call it, or work trust or something, of people who helped write applications to the FCC for a bunch of these stations, including WEFT. There were two or three engineers who were kind of associated with this movement that helped do the engineering parts of the applications for a whole lot of stations, including WEFT. There was one guy, Lorenzo Milam, who had inherited some money, and he wrote pledges on the understanding that you're never going to collect this, right? But at that time, you had to, when you went to the FCC, you had to show that you had a certain amount of financial resources or they wouldn't give you your license. So he wrote pledges. He pledged like the same money to several different stations to help them get their FCC license. There was this kind of whole wave of community radio organizing and building and getting on the air that went on then. So yeah, Champaign-Urbana was in there. We hosted several meetings. We had people coming. We had Midwest meetings and national meetings in Champaign-Urbana, where people who were involved in the movement came in, and we met at the Channing Murray Foundation and the McKinley Foundation. And so WEFT and people from Champaign-Urbana were very involved all through these early days of the community radio expansion.
That was Bill Thomas, a founding member of Community Radio WEFT, discussing the station's early days in the 1970s and 80s. And this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. In just a moment, we'll hear from community radio pioneer Jeremy Landsman. Jeremy Landsman is a living piece of community radio history. He's a major character in the classic book, Sex and Broadcasting, a handbook on starting a radio station for the community, having worked to construct many radio stations in the 1960s and 70s, including the first non-Pacifica listener-supported community radio station in the country, KRAB in Seattle. He also founded what very well may have been the first commercial freeform radio station in the country, KDNA in St. Louis. Since that first golden age of community radio building, Jeremy Landsman hasn't stopped tinkering with the airwaves. He's since moved to Anchorage, Alaska, where he constructed a TV station and has been involved in a variety of unique side projects. Some of these include creative utilization of FCC regulations to forge new frontiers in the use of broadcast spectrum, like running TV stations masquerading as radio stations and homebrewing the first ever DTV signal in the Anchorage market with parts he scavenged off eBay. Recently, John Anderson had a chance to have a wide-ranging conversation with Jeremy Landsman about the growth of community radio, its resurgence in the form of low-power FM stations, and what it's like to be an independent TV station owner in an age of consolidated media.
Thanks for coming on the show, Jeremy. It's nice of you to take some time out and talk with me about all of this wonderful
You're
stuff
welcome.
That's going on in the media. I want to talk a little bit about, for the listeners who don't know who you are, how you came to be so involved in broadcast engineering and technology and things like that. And I'm going all the way back to, you know, like the 60s and 70s and the setting up of all these non-commercial community radio stations you were involved in. Could you tell me a little bit about how you became involved in the establishment of community radio stations around the country?
I like to say these days that I was a little bit of an Asperger's kid, and I like a lot of people I knew when I was younger, felt pretty estranged from society in general, and I found a lot of positive reinforcement from dinking around with wires and resistors and stuff like that when I was a kid, so that kind of got me started with technical stuff. For some reason, I got really interested in the idea of non-commercial radio when I was in high school, and I don't know how I did that because I was in St. Louis. So I had heard somewhere that there was a radio station with no commercials. I thought, well, that's an interesting thought. And this is 1950s, so I wound up in California as my family split up, and I volunteered at the station. That was KPFA, so that was late 50s. It was the only thing there was. As time went on, I dropped out of high school, went to find a job somewhere, and naturally enough, I found a job in radio after getting an FCC first phone, which was my job ticket. And I always wanted to be a chief engineer, so that's sort of like my first job. Well, the guy hired me. He said, don't touch anything. He didn't trust me. And the second job was a kind of sleazy little AM station somewhere, and That guy said the same thing, but then when stuff broke, I fixed it, and he got to like me. So my story is I achieved my life goal at the age of whatever it was, 16, 18, whatever, and it's all been downhill from there.
Okay, so the first time I heard your name was when I was reading Sex and Broadcasting.
Oh, yes.
And the wacky fun times that it was going around establishing non-commercial community radio stations. How did the critical mass come together among various communities to start these community radio stations? And what was your role? I mean, you were the tinkerer. You were the one who came in and made sure the transmitter worked. Did you have any say in how these stations were actually self-organized? Or were you just kind of a traveling geek in a way?
No, combination. The truth of the matter is that everybody thinks they can do a better job than wherever they learned. And I learned a lot later after this job that I left. I wound up in Seattle helping to build a station called KRAB. And KRAB was the first not Pacifica listener-supported station. Every time we start one of these things, somebody thinks they can do a better job. And the angrier they get, the more likely they are to build their own station. And so I had a number of people who thought they could do a better job. Some of them left angry. Some of them were really happy. Some of them I helped. Some of them I did not. But they all started stations of their own. And so I think there are more stations than I know about or can remember. A lot of them started by ex-staff who weren't necessarily happy with what I did. When I was doing my own station, because I wound up doing the same thing as everybody else, I started one in St. Louis.
Was that KDHX?
It is now. Okay. The successor to KDNA, which was on a commercial channel. I had thought that you could do interesting radio and make it commercial. But I guess like Lewis Hill, who thought he could do that with Pacifica, that I was wrong.
And what are we talking about, like, as far as costs go? I mean, how did you manage to do this back in the day? Was it obviously pretty much on a shoestring?
Oh, most of them were shoestring stations. The Super shoestring. In the 70s, you could do Class D stations, which were based on 10-watt transmitters. And part of the way to get one of these things going, if you don't have any money, and most people don't, is to go around and ask friendly radio stations and engineers if they have any used equipment, and you might wind up with some. So I remember the station that's the premier, I guess, NPR affiliate now in the Monterey Bay Area, KUSP, started as a 10-watt transmitter sitting on a 55-gallon drum, something in the hallway, in the back hallway of a restaurant. And some people just got it on and got it going. That's a long time ago. And it grew from there, you know, a little bit at a time. Nowadays, you need more than 10 watts, and the engineering is likely to cost you a couple of grand. Of course, if you're in a really remote area, like I'm in Alaska now, you go to a place in Alaska where there are no signals, that's not a problem.
One of the things that has kind of, I guess, resurrected some of that ethos of the heyday of building community radio stations has been the FCC's relatively recent approval of low-power FM back in 2000, 2001. Do you see a lot of analogs between what you were doing initially 30-odd years ago or more and now what's happening today with LPFM?
During the barn raisings that I've seen, there are so many people who are so good that I barely fit in. And I'll also mention that sometimes people, although I'm sure a lot of people know more than I do, there are some people who think they do and don't, but don't want to hear anything from the old guard. So I felt like a little bit useless. But wandering around, I saw a lot of people busy, and you know, I just didn't push myself into it. There are a lot of smart people out there. Barn raising is a really neat idea. So somebody gets a permit for one of these things, Prometheus organizes this thing, and they use it as a kind of training workshop to spread more of them. Tons of people turn out, people who don't know much want to learn, people who know a lot and go do it, and those who think they know but don't necessarily. Everybody learns. Even me.
I was originally following the whole low power FM development because I was covering and involved in micro radio, unlicensed broadcasting, pirate radio, whatever you want to call it. Did you ever do any of that back in the day?
Back in the day, everybody who had technical inclinations did that. That's how they learn. Here's why one of the people who's dead set against LPFM in our state involved in the Alaska Broadcasters Association. I know friends of mine who say, oh, that guy used to be a pirate. How could he be so anti-LPFM? How could he, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, they forget their roots. And it's really sad, I think. That's how we learned. But you know what's interesting is that, I guess to me, is that unlicensed, I call it undocumented broadcasting, is not a technical matter for some people because the equipment is much more readily available, much more portable, and a lot less expensive than it was in the 50s and 60s. My first pirate FM broadcast transmitter I made by hand. It took me probably half a year. And it involved a bunch of tubes, and it was the first thing I made, actually, from ground up with, that actually worked. I knew somebody with an FM radio a block away, and I could hear it. I said, oh, that's kind of cool. Because there were no, I think we had one station in the town at the time.
Wow.
On FM, so who's going to notice except me?
That's right. It's over the years, I guess, undocumented broadcasting has become, as you said, like a little less technical to achieve, but slightly more political to undertake. I mean, most people that get involved in doing that type of radio now are doing it explicitly to make a statement about the FCC's spectrum regulation policies and the fact that, you know, that the allocation rules do not really reflect the technical reality on the ground. Do you see there still being a positive justification for continuing to do undocumented broadcasting in that political, in the political aspect today?
That's a tough one, actually. So I always go get licenses, and I don't think it's, I mean, I say that kind of cavalierly, but there's part of me that says, okay, well, all these people want to be in the band. First of all, a lot of them, you go look at the enforcement to see where people are busted for any of these things, or at least they get the notice of unlicensed operation. And they're in big cities. Well, look where I am. I'm in Anchorage. Why am I in Anchorage? Well, because there was a Channel 5 available here. People ask me, why did you come to Alaska to build a TV station? Well, I would have gone to New York, but Channel 5 was taken there. And, you know, part of me says, well, these people who want to make these statements, they're doing it where it's least needed. And part of me gets kind of angry about that. And I'm thinking, okay, there may be a number of unlicensed operators that have a political agenda. There are more of them that don't and just want to play music, and they think that's fun. And I don't think it serves any purpose. So, but there's another part of me that sees a long line of civil disobedience as being an important tool of political change in the role of Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi. And so, you know, you touch me and the conflicts will come out. I don't know where to go with this. Look, I operated a truly free speech radio station, and by truly, I mean we had all political viewpoints represented on the air. And we had a rule at our station. This is 1968 to 74. Anybody who wanted to get on the air was, by our own rule, 15 minutes, no questions asked. Say anything you want, as long as it didn't have gratuitous, vowel language. And people availed themselves of that, and it was sometimes pretty interesting, and more often not. But the point is that we provided that, and it was a huge struggle, you know, in the middle of the country during the Vietnam War. It was so much easier to be on the coast. I see a lot of the anti-totalitarian types, like me, wind up in the easy places where there are a lot of people of like mind. That doesn't serve us as a nation, I think, as much as going out and being a missionary for a while in the distant reaches.
Skipping forward now to how you got to Alaska, you said you ended up there because you wanted to set up a TV station, and that's where Channel 5 was. So you established KYES, right, in Anchorage?
Yep.
When did you start that station, and why did you decide to start that station?
Oh, for me, the why was, gee, you could make some money doing it. I've been doing all this stuff for no money for so long, and I need a retirement plan.
What was it like to make the jump between radio and TV?
Technically, it's much more challenging to have pictures, but it's not that much more challenging. I think what I learned, I started out in with KBDI, which is in the Denver market. And I think much more challenging that people just don't really grasp who aren't in the business is the copyright issues. You can't go down to Blockbuster and rent a bunch of movies and just go play them. You can go to the library and check out a bunch of records and play them on the radio. So what a difference. Whoa. It's the economic model that's different. What you haven't touched on with me yet is, how is it working in the age of consolidation? And that's, yeah, you know, I could be burning with rage about that. It's kind of interesting.
Well, you asked your own question. What is it like operating a television station, an independent television station, in an age of consolidation?
Well, the TV station is an affiliate of something. When WB started, we had WB and UPN on. Those got taken away from us, one and then the other. First one, because Warner Brothers decided that small markets were too small to bother with, so they were going to put everything on cable in a little box to play stuff all day. And then UPN decided to merge. So now I can't even think. I don't want to think of it. Rupert Murdoch's new network.
Oh, really? Irony of ironies.
Well, it's 2 hours a day. So, you know, what is it like? It's like being a pea that's still floating on a rough sea, bouncing around, and all the big waves are being made by the big players. And I can't imagine how come we are still here. What I do know is that there are very few single station owner operators left in the United States. It may be that KYES and Jeremy and his wife, Carol, are the only ones left pretty soon. We've heard there's one other. And I'll tell you what, it's not very nice. Basically, it feels like we are, I think I'm a slave to Hollywood. We are in an anchorage. There's not very much interest in consolidating somebody coming in and buying the fifth-ranking station in a market with 310,000 households where there are six commercial TV stations. You see, there's lots of spectrum here.
That was community radio pioneer Jeremy Landsman, interviewed in October 2006 by John Anderson. John is the producer of Free Press's Media Minutes, and his website is diymedia.net. And before we close out the show here, I unfortunately have to report the passing of a great WEFT volunteer who'd been with the station from the very start. Folks who listened to him on the air, who knew him at the station, knew him around the towns of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and read his column in High Times magazine, knew him as Chef Ra, his family and friends knew him as Jimmy Wilson. In many ways, he embodied the very spirit of WEFT, sharing good vibrations, the reggae sounds, and also a spirit of independence, a true sympathy and for the grassroots, and always an extremely forward-looking, freedom-oriented political perspective. He will be very much missed here at WEFT, and I think he'll be missed all around the country and around the world, where he's known for his travels in celebrating life, reggae, and the mighty ganja. We have some more information about Ra and his life at the WEFT website at weft.org. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. The program is also heard on 10 other community stations around North America. They are Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, and Free Radio San Diego. Media Geek is free to air on your local community station as well. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also the address where you can send your comments about the program. Once again, that's Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.